Thank you, Ollie, and thank you, Gordy. Ollie and Gordy are both two of my most inspiring friends, friends from decades ago, doing amazing work to improve healthcare in the United States, continuing to do so. Thank you. I also want to thank the medical care section for this award. The medical care section of APHA has really spawned many, many innovators in healthcare for the last, 50 years. It's an amazing organization. So thank you. So I thought I might talk about solving the primary care crisis without more doctors. So how many of you here are doctors? Well, we don't need you. Or me. How many people here think that primary care should be the backbone of all healthcare systems? How many people think that there's a crisis in primary care in the United States? So that's what we're going to talk about. Though most of the time we're going to talk about solving it and not about the depressing part of the crisis. So the healthcare system probably should look like this: lots of primary care, occasional specialists, and a rare hospital. But that's not what it looks like. Lots of hospitals, tons of specialists, and just a few little primary care practices. So this is an enormous structural problem that we have in the United States. And we have a very specific crisis on adult primary care. Pediatrics is really not in such bad shape. Adult primary care is really in difficulty. There are plummeting number of people going into primary care, declining access, burnout of practitioners, quality is unsatisfactory, and this is the primary care medical home.
Pediatrics isn't perfect either.
Nothing's perfect, no. Thank you. Okay, quiz. You can vote for one of the above. What percent of U.S. medical students enter adult primary care? How many people think it's 5%? 10%? 20? 30? The tens have it. So, general internal medicine, about 3% of U.S. medical students go into general internal medicine, and about 6% go into family medicine. So those are what I count as people who go into adult primary care. That was in 2010. In 2012, we got a lot better. Went from 9% to 9.6%. So why is this not happening? How many people think it's money? Work life? Culture of medical schools, which degrade primary care. It actually is all of the above, but there actually was one article, which you may or may not believe, that tried to compare how important money was with work life. And their conclusion was that they're both important, but if you look at the salaries of different specialties and you look at how many hours a day people in different specialties work, they concluded that work life was actually the most important reason. So that medical students, they see a primary care practice in a medical school, they see how unhappy the primary care doc is, and they say, this is not for me. So we're partly our own worst enemy. So why do we need to do something about this? Well, stressful work life is a big deal. This was a survey of general internists and family docs. What caught my attention was 27% burning out. It's one thing to be dissatisfied. Burning out means that you're ready to quit. And I know how that feels because I got burned out and I did quit. I lasted a long time, but finally I couldn't do it any longer. It's really, really hard. And physician burnout is not just about physicians. It's also about patients. So physician burnout is associated with poor patient experience and reduced patient experience to treatment plans. So when docs are unhappy, patients don't get very good care. Quality. And again, Donna Beattie is, of course, the great father of quality. I think now we tend to think of quality very, very broadly. He broadened the view of quality, but I think now we feel like the whole triple aim is related to quality. You know, the patient experience is quality, the population health is quality, and the cost of care is a quality issue also. So everything is quality these days. And just one thing that I always remember that Gordy Schiff said, if you don't have equality, you don't have quality. Thank you, Gordy. You did say that.
Equality or quality?
You need equality to have quality. Okay. Another little quiz. Hypertension. What percent of people in the United States have poorly controlled hypertension? You have three choices, 25% poorly controlled, 50%, or 75%. How many people think 25% have poorly controlled hypertension?
People with hypertension.
Thank you. 50%? 75%? Okay, it's actually fairly close to 50%, which is actually a great improvement from 10 years ago. How about diabetes? How many people think 25% have poorly controlled diabetes? 50%? 75%? It's actually close to 50%. It's gotten better. Cholesterol.
Half the people have some uncontrolled diabetes.
Half the people with diabetes have poorly controlled diabetes. Thank you for the clarification. Cholesterol. How many people think 25% of people who have hyperlipidemia have it under control? 50%? 75%? That's actually correct, 75%, which kind of surprised me. 50% of people with hypertension, 80% of people with high cholesterol, and 43% of people with diabetes are poorly controlled. Now, cholesterol is actually, in a way, the easiest thing to control, given statins. So why is it do so few people have well-controlled cholesterol? Anyone? Can't afford their medications is one thing. I mean, the medications are very powerful. We all know that the best way to control your cholesterol is lifestyle changes. Lifestyle changes are not so easy. Medications are very good. People don't take their meds. So 6 months after someone gets a statin prescription, most people are not taking that prescription anymore because either people don't like to take it, they feel fine, they don't really believe it's going to help them, and so forth, or they can't afford it. So quality, problem. Access, huge problem. 73% of adults who have a primary care physician or practitioner had trouble contacting the physician by phone, obtaining care after hours, or getting timely office visits. So quality, huge, access, huge problem. So that gets into kind of the meat of what we want to talk about today. And that is demand and capacity. So demand is all the people that need primary care. And as we know, it's going up as the population ages. It's going up as we have the epidemics of obesity and diabetes. Capacity is our ability to see people. In most places in the United States, adult primary care demand is greater than capacity. How many people think that in the practices that they're associated with or that they know about, that there are more people who need care than there are slots to see those people? So this is a huge, huge problem. So the answer that most health policy people put forth to the demand capacity problem is we need more clinicians. We need more MDs, more NPs, and more physician assistants. So they define capacity as practitioners, or I use the word clinician for those three kinds of people. That's how people define the problem. We need more clinicians. I would like to redefine the problem. The first thing about the way that this problem is defined is that all it does is depress you. Depresses me to define it this way. Because, according to Jack Colwell, who really looked at this very closely, if you look at the demand for primary care and you look at the supply of family docs and general internists, by 2020, there will be a shortage, a gap, between the demand and the capacity of 40,000. He used just physicians. He didn't use nurse practitioners or PAs. So that means that we need 40,000 more primary care, adult primary care physicians by 2020, and only 9.4% of people graduating from medical school go into those fields. Ain't going to happen. It is not going to happen. So either we just give up, or we say, well, we're not going to have primary care in the United States, or we try to think about a new way to deal with it and a new way to define capacity. How about nurse practitioners and PAs? Is that going to solve the problem? Well, it sure helps. 65% of nurse practitioners go into primary care, 32% of PAs go into primary care. But if you add up general internists, family docs, nurse practitioners, and PAs entering primary care, the primary care clinician to population ratio is still going to fall by 9% from 2005 to 2020. So nurse practitioners and PAs help, but nowhere near enough. Not going to do it. Does anyone think that doing something about the education of nurse practitioners, PAs, and physicians will solve this problem of lack of adult primary care? I don't think it's possible. Are we going to give up? No, we're not. I'm not going to give up. No way. The whole issue of panel size is a fascinating issue. Panel size, of course, is the number of patients that are impaneled to a primary care clinician. Average panel size in the United States is very hard to figure out. The best thing that I could find is that it's about 2,300 people. Now, in community health centers, it's less because there's a lot more, people have a lot more difficulty navigating the system and more language issues. The poverty, of course, creates more illness and so forth. But the average seems to be upwards of 2,000. If you look at the work that the Family Medicine Department at Duke has done, they calculated if you have 2,500 average patients, it would take 7.4 hours per day to do only preventive care. If you want to be a perfect preventive care clinician, that's how long it would take you. No acute care, no chronic care at all. And if you want to do good, perfect chronic care for that average panel of patients, that's another 10.6 hours. So 18 hours a day to do chronic and preventive care. You haven't done acute care. You haven't done care coordination, you haven't had lunch, and you haven't slept. So again, this is an impossible situation. This is like the lone clinician without a team. So here is the problem, which of course you could all say as well as I can. Panel sizes are too large, but we can't reduce them because of the shortage of primary care clinicians. The shortage means larger panels, poorer access, poorer quality, and more burnout. More burnout means that even fewer medical students are going to want to go into primary care. So it's a death spiral. It goes down. Unless we think differently. So this is the depressing one. Look at the gap between demand and capacity. But there's another way to do it. Look at that. Capacity almost meets the demand by 2020. How do we do that? Magic. It's not about doctors. It's about sharing the care. And I want to just say a word about my two colleagues that have helped work on this work that we're doing, Amira and Rachel. Could you just stand up? This is a team effort. So a lot of us believe in teams. We think that healthcare is a team sport, teams is a good thing. Just if you ask people, do you think it's good to have teams? Everyone says, oh yeah, we need teams. Absolutely have to have teams. Why do we need teams? So it's... there was a physician who worked a lot in community health centers back in the 70s, Harold Wise. Do you know Harold, Ollie? So he wrote a wonderful book called Teams and Building Teams in Primary Care. I forgot exactly the title. But at one point, he was so frustrated trying to get his teams to work in his community health center that he said, the best size for a team is a team of one. Teams are hard. You have to communicate with each other. You have to get along with each other. You have to figure out who's supposed to do what. Then you have to coordinate. You have to spend time talking to each other. A team of one is much more simple. So why do we really want teams? Number one, it can be done. Clinics have done it. But it really requires sharing the care. And sharing the care, we'll talk about in a few minutes, is not just a slogan. It is a slogan. But it's also a very concrete sort of way to change how one does things. Because a lot of people, if you read the literature on teams, it's not that great. A lot of people will say, we need teams because we have to communicate, and the way you build a team is you communicate with each other and you figure out what each other does, but doesn't really talk about the glue that puts a team together. So a lot of clinics have actually created high-performing teams. Without payment reform, it's difficult to do because with fee-for-service payment only for clinicians, the other people in the team are an expense and not a revenue source. So we really need payment reform. But a lot of people have created teams even before payment reform comes. But to really make this happen in a widespread way, we have to have payment reform. The fundamental thing about teams is that if teams do not increase capacity, they're probably not worth having. Remember, our problem is our capacity is not even close to what the demand is. We're not going to get enough doctors, nurse practitioners, and PAs to solve that problem. So we need other people on the team to step up. They have to share the care. If the team is not able to provide more care for more patients than not having a team, then it's probably not worth having a team. The team has to add capacity. So one of the things that we did, and we worked with, there were about five or six people that did this. Rachel and I did some of these site visits, but we site visited a bunch of high-performing practices to see how they worked all over the country. And the very interesting thing about these practices was that they tended to look alike. Now, not exactly alike, but they tended to have certain characteristics in common. And what we did was we took the observations that we made at these high-performing practices and we tried to categorize them in what we call the building blocks of high-performing primary care. And these are the building blocks. One of the things that people always say is, you need a patient-centered building block. Well, patient-centeredness should be in all the building blocks. So the fundamental building blocks are the four blocks on the bottom. Engage leadership. You have to have good leadership. It ain't going to work. You have to have data-driven improvement, as Donna Bedian would, I'm sure, agree with. You have to empanel people so that each patient knows who their clinician is and each clinician knows who their list of patients is. And then you need the teams. From there on, we can move on to access to population management, which we'll talk about, continuity of care, and so forth, access. But I'm going to spend the limited time here, because we could spend hours talking about all these building blocks, on two of them, which are related to each other, which is team-based care and population management, because these are the ones that are related to our need to increase capacity without more doctors. So we have a bunch of components of the team-based care building block, and we're going to talk about just three of them, which is the culture shift, the stable teamlets, and the standing orders. I want to start with the teamlets. So teams can be big. They could be 6 people, 8 people, 15 people. We have some teams in academic medical centers that have like 30, 40 people. Most of them are very, very part-time. But a teamlet is the core of a team. It's usually 2 or maybe 3 people, and it's generally the clinician and the medical assistant. Now, a teamlet concept goes back to the old days when you'd have a GP maybe working out of his, it always was his, house, and then maybe his wife or maybe someone else was the nurse, and she would work with him maybe for 30 or 40 years. My uncle had a teamlet with a nurse for like 30 years up in Seattle. The patients got to know both of the people on the teamlet. They trusted them both. The two of them knew how to work together. They knew who was good at doing what. So the trust was not only in the doc, it was in the teamlet. And the thing about the teamlet is it's very small. You can say, well, what would a patient think about? Most patients would say, you know, what do you want to do about your health care? Say, well, I want a good doctor. We're saying, no, you want a good team. The patient might say, well, I don't want a good team, I want a good doctor. If you have a very small team, like a couple of people that the people can learn how to trust, it's much easier to transfer the trust from trust in a physician to trust in a team with a small team in which the people on the team really know you and you really know the people on the team. And also it makes it much easier for the team to communicate with each other. It's much easier for two people to communicate than for six people to communicate. So it gets around some of the problems of team. So maybe Harold Wise would say the best team is a team of one, but the second best team is a team of two. If you look at these practices that we visited, most of them had stable teamlets in which usually the medical assistant and the clinician would work together either all the time or most of the time, so they got to know each other and how to work with each other. And we feel like that's a fundamental part of a good primary care practice. Rachel's done some work on looking at how people feel about working in teamlets. And this work, which was done in the Department of Public Health system here in San Francisco, people were more satisfied, clinicians, this was docs, nurse practitioners, PAs, were more satisfied when they worked in a teamlet, stable teamlet, working with the same medical assistant, than if they didn't have a team or even if they had a team working with a few medical assistants. So the clinicians like working in teamlets. Share the care. Share the care means that non-clinicians will assume responsibility for care that does not require an MD, NP, or PA level of training. Let me just do a time check, Gordy. Where are we at here?
Probably another
10 minutes. Okay. Thanks. So, non-clinicians assuming responsibility in order to increase capacity to solve this horrible dilemma that we have about primary care. And this can be done in many ways, population management, individual care, from patients adding capacity, and technology. Also partnering with public health and the community. Again, we share the care in order to improve access. Now one thing again that people will say is the relationship between the patient and the clinician is fundamental to good health care. And we agree with that. We think that teamlets are the best way to have a team and to still preserve that relationship. So the relationship is important. Okay, let's talk about some of the ways in which one can share the care and increase capacity without more doctors, nurse practitioners, or PAs. So population management is one way, which is not only to think about the patients who are coming in today, but to also think about all the patients on your panel. So if you have a bunch of patients on your panel, one of the things that they all need is what we call panel management, which is preventive care. Remember, preventive care could take 7.4 hours per day. Most preventive care services can be done by someone who's not a clinician. So let's just look at panel management means you have your registry of all your patients. And you look at the registry and you see who's overdue for cancer screening or immunizations or different things. You identify those patients and you try to get them in to get that care. And you need standing orders so that medical assistants can do panel management. We also know that quality is better when someone else does this, because if you save this for doctors to do, a lot of times they don't do it because they're dealing with other issues. So let's look at mammograms, for example, for a woman between 50 and 75 years old, all of whom should have a mammogram every 2 years. So the old way, the clinician gets a reminder, if you're lucky, that you need the mammogram. At the next visit, the clinician maybe orders the mammogram, clinician gets the result, and maybe notifies the patient. The new way, this is increasing capacity without the need for more doctors. The medical assistant checks the registry. If the patient's due for a mammogram, the medical assistant sends an order to the patient. The result comes to the medical assistant, and if the mammogram is normal, she notifies the patient. If it's abnormal, she notifies the clinician. For most patients, the clinician is not involved at all, not even conscious that all this is going on. For women 40 to 50 who may need or want a mammogram, there you have a clinician discussion. This is similar for colon cancer screening. You have to have standing orders to empower the medical assistant to do all this. And we can probably allocate about 50% of preventive care away from the clinician with panel management. If you take your panel of patients, you can also say, well, some of them have like one or two maybe chronic diseases, maybe diabetes, hypertension, cholesterol. These patients need health coaching. They need someone to work with them to make sure they understand their disease, they understand their medications, to work with them on lifestyle change, to make sure they understand the care plan that the clinician is providing for them, and to work with them on medication adherence. We did a study, have medical assistants trained as health coaches. We're doing a study of that now. We did one with, not with medical assistants, but with people with bachelor's degrees. And we counseled them on their medication use, and their systolic blood pressures on the average went down by 20 points. And most of that was not changing their medications, it was helping them to actually take their medications. We think that about 25 to 30% of all the chronic care needs could be done by medical assistants trained as health coaches. Here's a picture of a health coach and a clinician as a teamlet working together with a patient with diabetes. Excuse me? Yeah, the patient's the more elderly lady sitting there. So let's look at chronic care and how one might increase capacity to do chronic care without the need for more doctors, nurse practitioners, or PAs. Current way, clinician sees today blood pressure, refills meds, makes follow-up appointment. No one addresses medication adherence. Often the blood pressures are not adequately controlled. New way, medical assistant checks the registry every month. People with abnormal blood pressures are contacted for a pharmacist, RN, or health coach visit. Health coach does education, medication adherence, lifestyle changes. Patients are taught blood pressure monitoring. If the blood pressures are elevated and the patient's med adherent, the RN or pharmacist may intensify their meds using standing orders. If there are questions, there might be a clinician consult, though in general, that pharmacist knows more about the med than the docs anyway. There's health coaching by phone or email to deal with medication adherence, not eating so much salt, and so forth. Again, so Kaiser, for example, in Northern California, remember, 50% of people with high blood pressure in this country don't have it controlled. Kaiser, Northern California, 85% of people have their blood pressure controlled. Why? They took it away from the doctors. The pharmacists do it. Other ways to share the care to increase capacity. RNs can treat uncomplicated urinary tract infections, URIs, STIs, low back pain without clinician involvement with equal quality and better patient satisfaction. Physical therapists can manage low back pain better than clinicians. And you could have people with back pain go to physical therapists first, and only if they have red flags, which indicate a severe problem, would they go to the clinician, the opposite of the way we do it now. You could take your panel of patients and say, I'm going to create a sub-panel of my patients with all the people with diabetes, hypertension, cholesterol. They're going to be taken care of by the RN or the pharmacist. I'm not going to even deal with them at all unless they ask me a question. And they can probably do a better job than I do. And then complex care management can be done by an RN that helps take care of people who are very complex. Their physicians are involved, but it takes a lot less of the physician's time. So a lot of ways to share the care to increase capacity without more clinicians. Patients. We think of patients as the problem. They're the ones that need all the care. Well, patients can help with capacity also. So you can train patients as peer health coaches or peer educators. In the VA, diabetic patients paired with similar patients to support each other had greater glycemic improvement than patients with nurse care managers. The patients did better than the nurses. Latino diabetic patients with peer-led classes had better glycemic control than usual care. There's several, and we did one of the studies, which just is going to come out shortly. We've trained peer coaches, low-income peer coaches, with diabetes to take care of other patients with diabetes. There's a randomized controlled trial. The people who had coaches had significantly better hemoglobin A1Cs than the people without coaches. This is our training of some of our peer coaches. Here's a mirror training them. Self-care. People can do a lot of stuff themselves. We know that people with home blood pressure monitors who self-titrate their medications can get better blood pressure control than that achieved by doctors. We know that people on anticoagulation who home monitor and self-titrate their warfarin doses can get better control than that done by doctors. And then technology is enormously powerful to increase capacity without the need for more clinicians. So remember we talked about panel management and having the medical assistants do panel management for people for preventive care? You actually don't even need the medical assistants. Computers could do it. Just to remind the patients what they need, and then the patients should take care of it themselves. You can take standing orders and you can program them into a computer to determine who needs medication refills and who can have medication refills safely without any person involved at all. There's no reason why we can't do these things and enormously increase capacity and take time, unnecessary time off of the physicians. I'm getting there, Gordy. Don't get nervous. Here's another one. Uncomplicated urinary tract infection. We know that you do not have to go to the physician if you have an uncomplicated urinary tract infection. So you could enter your symptoms into a kiosk/vending machine. If there are no red flags like fever or multiple antibiotics in the past, you could press a button and 3 days of antibiotics would come out of the machine. Why can't we do that? It'll increase capacity without the need for any more people. Partnering with public health and the community. So with a colleague named Dave Moskowitz and I, we talked about this whole issue of evidence-based medicine, which is kind of everyone believes in evidence-based medicine. Yeah, it's a good thing, but it's not enough. It doesn't help people integrate the guidelines into their lives, and it doesn't deal with the toxic physical and social environment that we all as public health people know exists. So we created this concept called evidence-based health, which is different from evidence-based medicine. It adds to evidence-based medicine self-management support, which is health coaching, to make sure that people understand the guidelines themselves. And it adds community health component to address the toxic environment. So the formula is evidence-based health is evidence-based medicine plus self-management support plus community health. And again, you can do a lot. Someone talked previously about the diabetes prevention program. It's a great example of what you can do in the community, again, to increase capacity without the need for more clinicians. So, final points. Sharing the care means non-clinicians assuming responsibility for care, patients not only receiving but providing care, technology, and partnering with public health and the community. We need payment reform to do that, but we could start doing it now. And these things all add capacity without needing more clinicians. So, share the care. We can solve the primary care crisis. We don't necessarily need 40,000 more doctors. Thank you very much.
Let's do a few minutes of questions for Tom. I hate it when they defer the questions and people's thoughts are not fresh. Cup, hand there, yeah.
Could you speak a little bit more to the team relationship with resources like exercise, nutrition, activities, but when you don't have a very good public health system, you
Well, you know, people have been talking for decades about integrating public health with primary care, and it's not happening. It is just not happening. There are some glimmers of hope, I think. I think the Vermont Blueprint for Health, did anyone hear from Vermont? Close. So I think the Vermont Blueprint for Health that has these community health teams working with the primary care practices is an attempt to integrate community health issues with primary care and maybe an answer that a lot of us could look to try to solve this problem. But this divorce between public health and primary care is really not a healthy thing. The payment model, of course, is a problem. In Vermont, the health plans are actually putting money in to support the community health teams, but they're not going to keep doing that unless there's a return on investment, which is that the community health teams are going to be able to reduce hospitalizations and ED visits and specialty visits. So let's hope that they're doing very good data collection to see if that's going to happen. And if it does happen, I think this could really spread.